far as I can recall, there's only been one occasion, at least in my adult life, when I've ever felt utterly helpless. We were on holiday some years ago in North Devon, and I decided to walk the coastal path, to walk it on my own, because it was a rather long path, aiming to meet the rest of the family at a beach where they preferred to spend the morning, some miles away. Those of you who know North Devon will be aware of its magnificent cliff scenery. After an hour or so, I got rather irritated because the official path I was walking didn't really give me a good enough view of that scenery. So I decided to leave the marked track and follow the cliff a bit more closely. There was no problem for a while. I achieved my purpose perfectly. From the cliff edge, I obtained a much improved sight of the rugged landscape. But suddenly the terrain disintegrated, and I found my further progress blocked by a coombe, a rocky and precipitous coombe that had been cut into the cliff by a stream. I was faced by a choice. Either I retraced my steps over a mile to rediscover the coastal path, or I undertook to scramble across this cliff face. It looked very easy from the distance. It surely couldn't be dangerous, I said to myself. But as any of you will know who've ever done rock climbing, there's always one point when you're exactly halfway across a rock wall when you seem to run out of footholds. And that's what happened to me then. I overstretched and I slipped and found suddenly my hands clinging to the rock above me had temporarily become the only source of friction between me and the rocks. And there was a very steep and formidable precipice underneath me. Fortunately, the moment passed quite quickly. I scrambled around with my feet and somehow found a toehold and made it across. The only damage sustained was that in the scramble, I tore the sole partly from my boot, which proceeded to flap in a humiliating and conspicuous way at every step for the remainder of the journey. It was a very salutary experience, though, and the memory of it is embedded on my mind now as I recall it, almost as vividly as the day it happened. It was the first and the only time I can remember when I felt like shouting, as in all the best adventure stories, "Help!" But it wouldn't have achieved anything if I had, of course. For I was alone on that cliff face. Utterly alone. And utterly helpless. Maybe you have experiences like that that you can recall. A moment of danger or of despair. A moment when you felt yourself confronted by a situation you just couldn't handle. Where tragedy even seemed to be staring you in the face and there was nothing you could do about it. Except maybe to shout, "Help!" If so, I want to invite you this morning, like me, to recapture the emotion associated with that moment. Because drawing on some experience like that is going to help you to engage with this Bible passage we want to study. In chapters 4 and 5 of the Gospel of Mark, the evangelist is recounting four incidents in the life of Jesus, and though each has distinctive features of its own, all these four incidents have one thing in common. They all depict a situation of human powerlessness. They each have people in them at the end of their tether, defenseless victims of circumstances completely beyond their control, clinging, as it were, to the cliff face by their fingertips and crying help. Let me point out those four incidents to you. The first one is at the end of chapter 4, verse 35 it begins. It's a storm at sea. When evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. And there were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat, so that it was nearly swamped. Middle Eastern peoples, even today to some extent I understand, entertain a superstitious dread of the sea. In their mythology, the sea was closely associated with the primeval forces of chaos, which they believed God had to subdue in order to create an ordered universe. And as a result, there was something sinister and malevolent about the sea. The thought of it generated a rather similar anxiety in them to that which words like radioactivity or nuclear energy generate in the minds of some people today. The sea represented those dangerous, untamable energies that underlie the material universe and defy all man's proud attempts to harness them. Here, in this incident that Mark describes on the Lake Galilee, these disciples of Jesus found themselves quite literally at the mercy of those titanic elemental forces. They were helpless. The second incident's the one we read. A story about a violent lunatic. Verse 2 of chapter 5. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs. No one could bind him, not even with a chain. He tore chains apart and broke irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. I suppose many of us, faced with a passage like that, want to ask ourselves how Mark's interpretation of this man's behavior would relate to modern psychiatric evaluations of this kind of symptom. We're told he suffered from manic fits of violence, far in excess of what a sane man would be capable of. We're told he had suicidal tendencies and inflicted mutilation on himself. We're told that in verse 9 he experienced a complete disintegration of his own personality and had lost touch with his own sense of identity. We are legion, he said. It's not difficult to perceive in that kind of case history symptoms of what today would almost certainly be diagnosed as a psychotic mental illness. Mark, however, says that he was a man with an evil spirit, that he was demon-possessed. How are we to treat those two descriptions? Some of us perhaps would want to dismiss the demonic element altogether as an example of primitive mythology. But if we do, then we're going to have trouble with the pigs. For something got into them, all right. And if it wasn't the lunatic's demons, what was it? Others of us, perhaps, in our suspicion with humanistic science, want to dismiss the modern psychiatric description altogether as an example of the skepticism which so often today undermines biblical authority. But we, if we take that line, I think, are going to have real problems facing up honestly to the unambiguous medical evidence that psychotic behavior of this sort can indisputably sometimes be caused purely by organic things like brain tumors or drug addiction or even genetic factors, perhaps. Still others, perhaps, will want to have their cake and eat it, have a dualistic solution, suggest that some cases of mental illness are psychiatric, if you like, and others are demonic, and that we need a gift of spiritual discernment to distinguish the two. Which is a pleasing solution to the problem. The only problem with that is that there's really no evidence that I can find in the New Testament of that kind of distinction. It seems to me quite certain that any insane person in the first century would have been labelled demon-possessed. No other vocabulary was available. They used the phrase, he has a demon, in exactly the same way we use the phrase, he's off his head. He's mad. So my own view for what it's worth on this vexed question is that we ought to avoid both dualism and reductionism and see the biblical and the psychiatric accounts of mental illness as complementary rather than contradictory descriptions. After all, the Bible says we human beings are strange, psychosomatic creatures who live on the boundary of two worlds, the physical and the spiritual. The Bible tells us illness can invade our psychosomatic unity from either of those spheres. And when it does, it will have symptoms that affect both parts of us, the physical and the spiritual, the mind and the body. And just as illness can invade us from either sphere, the physical or the spiritual, so the Bible insists healing can be sought via either sphere, the physical or the spiritual. And when it's successful, it will bring relief to both areas, mind and body. Just then as we may bring both prayer and medicine to bear on a person suffering from, say, cancer, I don't really see why we shouldn't bring both exorcism and psychiatry to bear on a person who's mentally ill. Well, you may like to talk about that over lunch. What's absolutely clear to me, though, is that there are many mentally and emotionally sick people today who feel just as desperate, just as powerless, as this man Jesus met in the tombs felt. All efforts to heal him had failed abysmally. Society had given up on him, pushed him out into the cemetery. He'd had his taste of the straitjacket, and it didn't help. Now, there are people like this man today who feel themselves, their whole personality, in the grip of alien forces. And whether you regard those forces as real or imaginary, they are irresistible. As irresistible as that tempest on the Sea of Galilee. So however you interpret mental illness, the fundamental point I want you to grasp is that no one could help this man. And he couldn't help himself. He was helpless. The third story Mark tells us along these lines begins in verse 25. It's rather wedged, intercalated among the fourth story. It's the story of a chronic invalid this time. Verse 25, a woman was there who'd been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She'd suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. I think it's almost certain that this woman's problem was gynecological in nature. She had some kind of uterine hemorrhage. And if that is so, as I think almost certainly it was, it must have rendered her permanently unclean by the standards of Jewish ceremonial law. So though she wasn't a lunatic, in some ways she was no better off than that lunatic. She too was not just sick, she was a social outcast. And like him, no one had been able to do anything for her either. I wonder perhaps if Mark has his tongue slightly cynically in his cheek as he wrote that bit about the fortune she'd spent on medical fees without any improvement in her condition to show for it. I'm afraid charlatan physicians were all too common in the ancient world. Only the desperate consulted them, and only the fortunate survived them. In this woman's case, instead of getting better, we're told, she got steadily worse. Clearly, her condition, however it would have been diagnosed today, was incurable by treatments available to first century medical science. She, too, was helpless. And so we come to the fourth story, perhaps the most moving of all. A bereaved parent. Verse 22. One of the synagogue rulers, named Jairus, came. And seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." There are few experiences more shattering than bereavement, and few bereavements more devastating than the loss of a child. Some of you here, I know that firsthand. In fact, it won't be difficult for any of us here who are parents to project ourselves imaginatively into the desperation of this man Jairus. "My little daughter is dying," he says. Can't you feel the heartbreak? The desolation? Some of us who, like him, have stood at the bedside of our children when they've been seriously ill, we know the desperation he was suffering, the tears he was fighting back, the blind panic that was driving him. His little girl had a terminal illness. There was nothing that could be done. Like that storm on the sea, like that violent demon possession, like that incurable hemorrhage. It was all beyond human remedy. This poor father could do nothing but wring his hands in agonized helplessness. Four pictures, you see, of people at the end of their tether. People defenseless before circumstances beyond their control, clinging to that cliff face by their fingertips. And unlike me, finding no toehold at all. What are you to do in such circumstances? Well, Mark tells us what these people did. Each of them, he says, cried for help. And more to the point, each of them found it. The way their appeal for assistance was expressed was different in each case. In the case, for instance, of the sailors in the boat, their cry for help came out as a rather churlish question. Verse 38. The disciples woke Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" How many people under the stress of great anxiety have snapped that kind of indignant recrimination at those around them? "Don't you care? How can you sit there so calmly?" We say it to our marital partners. We say it to our parents. We say it to our pastor sometimes. And sometimes we say it to God. "Don't you care?" The interesting thing is that Jesus disregarded the impudence of the question altogether. Instead of treating it as an accusation, he treated it as an invitation. He was wise enough, a counselor, you see, to know that when anxious people say, "Don't you care," what they're really meaning is, "Can't you do something? Help." So he did. Verse 39, he got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down. And it was completely calm. There's only one word for that. Power. Superhuman power. Power to tame the primordial energies of the universe. Power to change helplessness in the face of a storm to hope, to calm. In the case of that violent lunatic, the cry for help took a different form again. A tortured, defensive rebuttal of Jesus' assistance. Verse 7. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God you won't torture me." It's interesting how often, you know, one finds in mentally ill people an uncanny intuition on spiritual matters. Many people at this time had no inkling at all of Jesus' messianic identity. Even the disciples were confused on it. But this lunatic sees it immediately. The demons in the man recognized the authority of Jesus and begged him not to cast them out, says Mark. I suppose a 20th century psychiatrist might have rather said, the patient has an interest in his bizarre behavior. And part of him, at least, doesn't want to be successfully treated. However you describe it, once again, Jesus saw through the negative in the man's response to the real positive that underlie it. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." He gave them permission. And the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. I have heard some people object to that on grounds of cruelty to animals. All those poor pigs. Reminds me of the incident in America a few years ago when a baboon's heart had been they'd attempted to transplant a baboon's heart into a human. And people were protesting then, I thought, about the whole idea of such transplants. But no, they were protesting for the sake of the baboon. I suspect Jesus would not have understood that kind of sentimentality. One human being is worth more than 20,000 pigs. And if it were not so, then slaughterhouses should be banned and butchers should be prosecuted for murder. Now, the real difficulty with this incident is not the morality of vivisection. It has nothing to do with that. The real problem with this is the logic of the involvement of these pigs in the first place. What were the demons afraid Jesus would do? In what way was being banished into a herd of pigs a preferable alternative? And what happened anyway to those demons after the pigs were drowned? I freely confess to you, I haven't the faintest notion of an answer to any of those questions. Neither have I found any commentary that's able to do more than speculate in the most wild fashions on the issue. But then I'm not sure I really expect to understand the politics of demonology. Jesus' whole exchange with this lunatic is taking place on a level far beyond my experience and comprehension. And sometimes maybe we just have to accept that about things we find in the Bible. All we can really know, we who have never known insanity of this kind, is what the local residents observed when they came to find out what was going on. Verse 15. They came to Jesus and saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed, and in his right mind. There is only one word for that. Power. Power such as you will not find in full-born. Power, I suggest, you will not even find in those churches that claim to be most adept at exorcisms. Superhuman power, unique to Jesus. Power to conquer the cruel forces of evil that prey upon human minds. Power to change the helplessness of that violent lunatic into hope. The third cry for help was neither an impudent question nor a defensive rebuttal. In fact, the third cry for help didn't even use words at all. It was, in fact, a superstitious gesture. Verse 27. When the woman heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Superstitious people often do attribute good fortune to touching things, don't they? They kiss the Blarney Stone, they bathe in the water at Lourdes. In fact, you must have heard someone say, touch wood. But once again, Jesus doesn't dismiss this superstitious gesture with the kind of contempt we might have expected. He sees beyond the superstition to the tiny glimmer of real faith that was beneath it. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body she was freed from her suffering. Verse 34, Daughter, he said to her, your faith, not your superstition, your faith has healed you. Again, there's only one word for it, and this time Mark himself uses it. Verse 30, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. Power, yes, to cure the incurable, to remedy the irremediable. Power to change the helplessness of a chronic invalid into hope. A And so we come to the fourth cry for help, the most distraught, the most poignant of them all. Verse 23. My little daughter is dying. Please come. Please come. We're told this man was an important official in the Jewish community, a ruler of the synagogue. A man like him would no doubt normally have been very conscious of his dignity. But panic born of this family emergency has thrown all such considerations to the wind, isn't it? Regardless of what his sophisticated colleagues in the synagogue might think. He falls at the feet of this peasant from Galilee and entreats him like a beggar in the street. Please come, he says. And at first it seems as if Jesus hasn't come quickly enough. Verse 35, while Jesus is still speaking, some men come from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter's dead, they said. Why bother the teacher anymore? But this man who commands the sea and the demons, this man has even power to command death. Verse 39, he said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. They laughed at him, but he put them all out. He took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. And he took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha kum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. No exhibitionism, no razzmatazz of the big healing meeting. Privately, in the bedroom. With words so tender and compassionate, Mark wants to tell us what they were in the original Aramaic, so we just catch the flavour of them. Little girl, get up. There's only one word for that. Power. Power to dispel even the shadow of the grave. Power to turn the helplessness of a bereaved parent into help. There's only one word for that. Power. Power to dispel even the shadow of the grave. Power to turn the helplessness of a bereaved parent into help. Now tell me, why do you think Mark recounts these four stories? What interest do you think he has in them? Is he just a journalist reporting some sensational incident? No, you know he isn't. Mark is writing a gospel, not a newspaper. He tells us these four stories because in his mind they are significant, hugely significant, for us personally. See, according to the Bible, we're all helpless. Helplessness is part of our human condition. Oh, we hide the truth from ourselves much of the time. But the truth is, we all live our lives under the shadow of the same kind of plight the people in these four stories were under. We're not in control of our destinies. On the contrary, we too are the pathetic prey of titanic forces beyond our mastery or even of our comprehension. Tempests, demons, suffering, death. This is the nature of the world we live in. Such evil and destructive powers victimize all of us in what the Bible calls this present age. This present age is the dominion of darkness, says the Bible. Because it wasn't meant to be like that. God made us human beings in his own image to have dominion ourselves over this world. But in our sinful folly, we chose the path of moral rebellion against God, and as a result of that choice, we forfeited our proper role in the universe. So instead of being monarchs, we find ourselves pawns defenseless pawns dominated by the power of evil, just as the apostle was telling us in those words we read earlier. Dead in our transgressions and sins, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature, objects of wrath. We're quite incapable of delivering ourselves from that bondage to evil power, says the Bible. And Mark, in telling these four little cameos, is trying to point up for us some examples of precisely how that bondage manifests itself in real-life drama. He wants us to share with the characters involved in this story the panic, the desperation, the distress which we human beings constantly experience by finding ourselves overwhelmed at our own impotence. To be a human being is to be helpless. Helpless. That says Mark. No longer hopeless. Something has happened. Something that throws a beam of light across this darkness of our human despair. The prophet said it would. The prophets in the Old Testament said the dominion of darkness won't last forever. A new age will dawn, they said. An age when mankind would be freed from their bondage to evil. Don't despair, they said. Things will change. And Mark calls this book he has written good news because he's convinced they have changed. The day the prophet spoke of has arrived. The time is fulfilled, he said. The kingdom of God has come. A man has stepped out of the wings of history who has power. Power to change things. Power to bring to an end the reign of darkness and to inaugurate the kingdom of light. And his name is Jesus. Mark is writing these stories, so that just as we empathized with the desperation and the panic of these men and women involved in them, so too we might identify with their cry for help. Maybe for some of us that cry will be nothing more than a rather bad-tempered complaint. Look at the mess I'm in, God, don't you care? Maybe for some of us it will be nothing more than a tortured rebuttal, born of a mind so confused it doesn't really know what it does want. Jesus, Son of God, don't turn my life upside down, please. Maybe for some of us, it'll be nothing more than a wordless reaching out, bordering on superstition, to a God we hope cannot see us. Maybe if I just go and sit in that church this morning, I'll feel better. Maybe for some of us, that cry for help will be nothing more than a wail of grief, scorched on our lips by the dying embers of a life more precious to us than our own. Please, Jesus, don't let my child die. But however that cry for help comes, whatever circumstances of human distress awaken it in our souls, Mark wants us to know it will be heard. To be a human being is to be helpless, but no longer to be hopeless. He's putting to us, you see, the same question Jesus put to the disciples in that storm-tossed boat. Verse 40. Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? He asked that question to each one of us this morning. Do you still have no faith? But the trouble with many people in this world is the answer is yes, they don't have any more faith. Like the men of Decapolis, we would rather Jesus went away than risk losing any more pigs. Like the relatives of Jairus, we would rather laugh at Jesus than take talk of resurrection from the dead seriously. Such people have no hope. They have no hope because they have no faith. Perhaps they've never been frightened by a storm. Perhaps they've never been tortured by mental illness. Perhaps they've never been exhausted by physical suffering. Perhaps they've never been devastated by grief. Maybe the reason God brings such miseries into our experience, for some of us, is not a mark of his anger, but of his mercy to us. For only those who know what it's like to cling to the rocks by their fingertips and feel all hope draining away beneath their feet, only when we felt like that, only when we felt desperation grip our hearts, will some of us proud, complacent, self-reliant human beings, cry for help. Yet it's help we need. For we cannot save ourselves. Every one of us must one day stand before God and give account of our lives. If we've never felt helpless before, I assure you we will feel helpless then. If we've never felt like praying before, I assure you we will feel like it then. Don't you see, today Mark is inviting us to put our trust in Jesus. Like these disciples, to pass beyond our intellectual questions into faith. Who is this that even the winds and sea obey him, they ask. We know who he is. To pass beyond our superstitious dabblings on the margins of religion. To come out from the crowd and confess our personal faith in Jesus. Daughter, your faith has healed you. To pass beyond our doubtings and our despair. To ignore, as Jesus ignores, the laughter of the skeptical. And to put our faith in one who has power even to raise the dead. Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid. Just believe. Don't be afraid. Just believe." Let's pray together.